Hello, everybody. Today is Friday, August 5th. I'm Bill Murphy here with the front pages. I'll be reading from the New York Times and the Hartford Courant. And we'll take a look at the pictures on the front page of each paper. And they're very, very similar. They're both of Brittany Griner. The one in the Times has her sitting in her cell. She has a glass of water, a bottle of water, and she's listening to the interpreter as he interprets what's going on in the sentencing. It says in the caption, Brittany Griner in the defendant's box. I guess that's where it is, not a cell. It's in the defendant's box, what they have in Russia. It's in a courtroom outside Moscow after the judge, Anna S. Sotniklova, imposed her sentence. And over to the Hartford Courant, it's a picture of Brittany Griner again, and she's holding a photograph of a basketball team. I'm not sure if it's must be the WNBA or Russia's, but there's a photo of the whole team sitting there with their photo taken. And I'm going to read the caption. She's holding it outside of the bars of the defendant's cell. WNBA star Brittany Griner holds a photograph while standing in a cage at a courtroom for her hearing near Moscow on Thursday. Griner was found guilty of drug possession, and the prospect of getting her back to the United States turned even more grim. Now, I did read the story of Brittany Griner in the sports, but assuming that many of you did not hear the sports, I'm going to read the article. This is from the New York Times, so it'll be slightly different, but it is probably the biggest news that happened yesterday in the United States and, of course, in Russia. The headline is 9-year term given to Griner pressures U.S. A Russian court on Thursday sentenced the American basketball star Brittany Griner to 9 years in a penal colony after convicting her on a drug charge, a harsh penalty that keeps her fate entwined with the geopolitical showdown over the war in Ukraine and ramps up already intense pressure on President Biden to win her release. The U.S. government contends that she is among several Americans who have been wrongfully detained by Russia, used as bargaining chips in the increasingly hostile relationship between Moscow and Washington. The Biden administration has offered a prisoner swap involving Ms. Griner, but Russian officials said it was premature to discuss a deal while her case was underway. Now that the trial is concluded, Mr. Biden faces a difficult choice between standing firm on his proposal to trade for Ms. Griner and another American, Paul N. Whelan, or sweetening the offer somehow with either a position liable to draw domestic criticism. The Kremlin, for its part, can use them as leverage with no incentive to resolve the cases quickly. Her supporters, voicing horror at the verdict and sentence, are clamoring for the president to do something while the administration is wary of giving in to Russian tactics that is all but labeled as blackmail. My administration will continue to work tirelessly and pursue every possible avenue to bring Brittany and Paul Whelan home safely as soon as possible, Mr. Biden said in a statement after the verdict. Ms. Griner, 31, one of sports' biggest global stars, sat mostly expressionless, eyes downcast, leaning her long frame toward the bars of the defendant box in a cramped courtroom outside Moscow to hear as the words of the judge, Anna S. Sotniklova, were quietly translated for her. She had already pleaded guilty, and conviction is all but certain in Russian court, so the verdict was a foregone conclusion. The real question was about the sentencing. The answer was devastating. The sentence was near the 10-year maximum for her conviction for attempting to smuggle narcotics into the country based on two vape cartridges containing hashish oil found in Ms. Griner's luggage when she arrived in February, a week before Russia's President Vladimir V. Putin sent his forces pouring over the border into Ukraine. She and her legal team had hoped for a more lenient penalty based on her guilty plea, her statement that she had not meant to take the cartridges to Russia, and testimony that she used the substance legally in the United States to manage pain. I made an honest mistake, and I hope that in your ruling that it doesn't end my life here, she said before the sentencing. She told the court that while she took responsibility for her actions, she was quoted to say, I had no intent to break Russian law. She said that after recovering from a bout of COVID, she had packed hurriedly to rejoin the Russian team she plays for in the WNBA offseason and had accidentally left the cartridges in her luggage. I know that everybody keeps talking about political pawn and public chatted, but I hope this is far from that courtroom. We have another story on the front page of the New York Times. At least 11 Chinese missiles struck seas north, south, and east of Taiwan on Thursday, less than 24 hours after Speaker Nancy Pelosi celebrated the island as a bulwark of democracy next to autocratic China. The People's Liberation Army declared that its missiles, quote, all precisely hit their targets, unquote, even as Japan said five landed in the water. The Chinese military called the exercises a prelude to a bigger show of force, intended to punish the island for a visit by Ms. Pelosi that challenged Beijing's claims to Taiwan. The drills, pushing ever closer to Taiwan and expected to run 72 hours, will also give Chinese forces valuable practice should they one day be ordered to encircle and attack the island. China's top leader, Xi Jinping, has said that he hopes to eventually unify Taiwan and China through peaceful steps as part of his vision for a rejuvenated and powerful nation. But like his predecessors, he has not ruled out force. And China's military buildup has reached the point where some commanders and analysts think an invasion is an increasingly plausible possibility, though still highly risky, scenario. Even if imminent conflict is unlikely, the exercises are putting the region on edge, and tensions could dangerously escalate, especially if something goes wrong, with the missiles landing near Japan seen as a message that China could hit the U.S. forces stationed there and intended as a warning to the government in Tokyo of the cost of its American alliance. The Japanese government on Thursday said that five Chinese ballistic missiles had fallen into its exclusively economic zone, the first time any had landed in those waters. Another missile, the government said, landed 50 miles northwest of Yanaguni, a small island at Japan's southernmost tip and just a short distance from Taiwan. The missile did not land in Japan's economic zone. Japan lodged a protest with the Chinese government. This is a grave issue that concerns our national security and the safety of the people, said Japan's Defense Minister Nobuo Kishi. At the White House, officials attempted a balance between showing that they would not be intimidated by the Chinese actions while looking for ways to de-escalate, and that uneasy mix was evident in a series of announcements on Thursday afternoon. John F. Kirby, national security spokesman, said the Pentagon had ordered the U.S. Ronald Reagan to remain on station in that region, but some distance from the entrance to the Taiwan Strait, a more cautious move that President Bill Clinton made in the 1996 Taiwan crisis when aircraft carriers moved closer to the action. At the same time, Mr. Kirby said the United States would resume freedom of navigation movements, transiting Navy ships through the Taiwan Strait, but was waiting several weeks, an indication the White House wants the current Chinese exercise to end first. It is a strategy that has echoes of President Biden's approach to Ukraine, arm Taiwan, but do not put American troops directly in harm's way. We're going to move over now to the Hartford Courant from Austin, Texas. A Texas jury on Thursday ordered conspiracy theorist Alex Jones to pay more than $4 million in compensatory damages to the parents of a six-year-old boy who was killed in the Sandy Hook Elementary School massacre, marking the first time the InfoWars host has been held financially liable for repeatedly claiming the deadliest school shooting in U.S. history was a hoax. The Austin jury must still decide how much of the InfoWars host must pay in the punitive damages to Neil Heslin and Scarlett Lewis, whose son Jesse Lewis was among the 20 children and six educators who were killed in the 2012 attack in Newtown. Parents had sought at least $150 million in compensation for defamation and intentional infliction of emotional distress. Jones' attorney asked the jury to limit damages to $8, $1 for each of the compensation charges they are considering. And Jones himself said any award over $2 million, quote, would sink us, unquote. It likely won't be the last judgment against Jones, who was not in the courtroom when the jury announced its decision to award $4.11 million over his claims that the attack was staged in the interest of increasing gun controls. A Connecticut judge has ruled against him in similar lawsuit brought by other victims' families and an FBI agent who worked on the case. The Texas award could set a marker for other cases against Jones and underlines the financial threat he's facing. It also raises new questions about the ability of InfoWars, which has banned from YouTube, Spotify, and Twitter for hate speech, to continue operating, although the company's finances remain unclear. Jones, who has portrayed the lawsuit as an attack on his First Amendment rights, conceded during the trial that the attack was 100% real, that he was wrong to have lied about it, but Heslin and Lewis told jurors that an apology wouldn't suffice and called on them to make Jones pay for the years of suffering he has put them and other Sandy Hook families through. Going back to the front page of The Current, the State Police Union is asking the U.S. Supreme Court to set aside part of the state's sweeping police accountability reforms that make some police personal records subject to public disclosure. The union's appeal, which has lost twice so far in federal courts, focuses primarily on public disclosure of internal affairs investigations that result in findings of exonerated, unfounded, or not sustained. The union contract, ratified by the state legislature in 2019, exempts unsubstantiated complaints from disclosure under state freedom of information law. In its appeal, the union argues that the provision in the reform law that permits disclosure violates the U.S. Constitution's contract clause, which prohibits states from passing laws that invalidate contracts without a compelling public interest. The state has so far turned back union appeals in the U.S. District and Circuit Court by arguing the state did have a compelling reason to nullify the contract language, the public demand for police accountability in the wake of the death of George Floyd at the hands of police in Minneapolis. In ruling against the first union appeal 2 years ago, U.S. District Court Judge Charles Haight wrote that national outrage over police tactics and the Floyd death created a legitimate public purpose for enacting a law that amended the union contract. In affirming Haight, the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Second Circuit wrote, as we have noted, making it easier for the public to access public records was a reasonable response to the genuine crisis in public confidence facing American cities and states in the weeks and months following the nationwide protests that Floyd's murder spurred. Here, the district court concluded that the FOI Act served two legitimate public purposes, ensuring the transparency and accountability of law enforcement and promoting FOIA strong legislative policy in favor of the open conduct of government and free public access to government records. We agree. It was all a quote. The strong public reaction to Floyd's murder made clear that the legislature was responding to an important and pressing social ill, the ruling said, because there is no indication that the Connecticut legislature acted self-servingly in passing the act at issue. In this case, we defer to its determination that the law was reasonable and necessary to address issues relating to police misconduct or accountability. The CSPU has not provided any compelling evidence that contradicts the determination, the judge wrote. The union argues that the language exempting unsubstantiated complaints from disclosure was negotiated into its contract at a time when baseless complaints against police were on the rise. It said the exemption was written to protect exonerated officers and their families from harassment. The union also is challenging the department's failure to comply in the wake of the reform laws, which contract language requiring troopers receive notice when a public records request has been made for their disciplinary files. The union argues in its appeal that the Supreme Court should take the case to resolve conflicts among three federal appeals courts on questions about state interference in public union contacts. The Supreme Court agrees to hear few of the appeals brought to it. A decision on taking the union appeal is likely months away.